Hello and welcome to the next segment of Buffalo Who Knew podcast series, which highlights the often underappreciated, sometimes unearthed assets of Buffalo, the great city of Buffalo. And I am so excited to be here with Megan McElfrisch, who is the executive director of the Stained Glass Association of America, which is housed in and based in Buffalo, and also with, of course, my compadre Newell Nussbaumer. Hello to you both.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course. So let's jump into it. So tell us a little bit of background about the Stained Glass Association and when was it founded? Why was it founded? Where was it founded? How did it come to Buffalo?
Absolutely. I have been actually weirdly looking into this a lot lately, because believe it or not, the association as a community first came together to pressure Congress for tariffs.
Oh, isn't that timely? Interesting.
Because American workers were paid three times more than their in a nutshell, and there were a lot of different things going on at the time, but it was a new industry to America. You can't have giant stained glass windows before you have giant buildings of a certain style and of a certain amount. And we had incredible craftspeople coming to America and trying to build work. And the glass houses of Europe followed them and set up shop and imported stained glass windows. And oftentimes it was cheaper to buy those windows from a German or an English or a French glass house than it was to have it built by an American studio.
And they had the history of craftsmanship, right, of course.
Right. And which was used often to say, like, well, we're much better than those Americans. You know, they don't know what they're doing.
And this is the mid-19th century?
This actually started as early as 1830. Mm-hmm. The first recorded American stained glass pictorial window is in the 1860s, and the Bolton brothers were entirely self-taught. And they took apart stained glass windows that were imported. They taught themselves, and as studios were trying to really gain a foothold and compete and have a thriving industry, they needed their representatives' help. It was a very long process. It took decades. Hard to believe.
Were they artists?
They were business people. By and large, most of the American companies wanted tariffs. They wanted some protection. It was actually the big studios like Tiffany and Lafarge that fought that initially. They wanted free trade because they felt like their artwork was so remarkable. They didn't really have competition. But in the end, they also supported the tariffs. And they were passed finally in 1903. Mm-hmm. So it took decades and decades for the industry to come together and figure out how to navigate all of these things. And so there were regional glassworker groups coming together, and it was the groups in Cincinnati, Buffalo, and New York City that really ended up forming the core 45 studios that became the Stained Glass Association of America.
Now, I'm just curious, were a lot of the participants and members of these regional groups, were they of, I mean, I imagine they were Europeans who had come over.
Many of them were, yes. Mm. Like, there weren't the same opportunities to build work in Europe anymore. They'd, you know, hit the boundaries of what had been built, and there was a building boom in America. So why wouldn't you come over here? And so they brought skill and talent and just a wealth of information with them. They weren't keen to bring the apprenticeship and guild system with them that had held them back from moving up in Europe, that had prevented them from striking out and making their own studios in Europe. So we have waves of talented artists coming into America to thank for having an industry here. And they did help us form the Stained Glass Association of America, but it's not a guild system. I think we have very over romanticized notions of what a guild is
mm-hmm.
anyway. But
and as a side note, let's recognize immigration is good.
Right.
Immigrants are good. They right. bring a lot to the table. Keep it going.
Just America. Absolutely brilliant work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it, you know, it, this association founded, so sounds like around 1903.
Right.
Where was it run out of?
Like a lot of associations, they didn't have they had a mailing address and a registration office out of the Columbus, Ohio area, but it has been any number of different places as it has had different board members and leadership involved. It's often followed the production of the magazine. So
has it ever been as formally established as it is now?
It had a staff and a set of offices around Kansas City, Missouri, when I was hired. And I joke about it now in retrospect, I think because it was a bit of a whirlwind and I think I was really shocked to get the job. I assumed there was someone out there who was more nerdy, that knew more about stained glass and enjoyed reading economics textbooks and building spreadsheets at night that would want the job. And so I think I made like a really cheeky comment during a call with David Judson, who is making the decision. And I said, well, you'd have to move the whole office to Buffalo. I don't know where Raytown, Missouri is, but I'm not moving there. I just moved to Buffalo a few years ago and I love it here. I'm not leaving. And I thought that'll do.
Deal breaker.
I'm not getting this job. And, he called me back maybe a week later and he said, go pack a truck.
Was he familiar about the legacy of stained glass in Buffalo?
He actually, bizarrely, was a bit. David Judson is the fifth generation of Judson Studios. It's one of the oldest studios in the nation. And Frederick Wilson was a founding artist there. And Frederick Wilson designed and led the construction of the windows at First Presbyterian over here behind Kleinhans. And so he was very familiar with the architecture and the stained glass in Buffalo. And I think, it was hard to leave Kansas City, but it was great to come to Buffalo. And weirdly, it feels like a full circle journey. It feels like coming home.
That's amazing. So let's talk about the association. What does it do? I mean, you mentioned the publication, The Visitor. I remember reading that it launched in 1906, not long after the founding of the organization, and it's now one of the longest running publications in the country.
Right, like it's our only means of written history about architectural stained glass in the United States. If no one else is going to write it down, at least we have it. So it's all of the major association news. It's our major means of communication with members. We share notable work, whether it's the work of our members or not, to inspire and educate. And really, community education and advocacy have always been the heartbeat of the organization. Even if we weren't thrilled with the idea of building a rigid guild system, because we felt, you know, I think initially reading a lot of what I've been through in the archives, we didn't, you know, it was such a new world here under construction. Why would we sort of back ourselves into a corner before we had to, is how I interpret it. But that didn't mean that there weren't educational issues that needed to be tackled across the industry. So as young, talented artists took advantage of the strength of the industry that had just been protected with tariffs, they needed to know how to price their work, because undercutting the work by one studio sort of affects how healthy we all are in an industry as small as ours. And as a region of studios would notice an issue or a problem, it allowed them to share it across the country. The preservation issues in Texas are not necessarily the same sort of maintenance issues we have in the Northeast, are not necessarily the same issues we have in California. So it allows members to compare things that are happening across the country as they're building work. You know, and of course, there was a raging boom in the 60s and 70s of, oh, let's smack Lexan over it. That'll save it all. You know, and the members were allowed, you know, were able to sort of say to each other, actually, this seems to be going really badly. We should not do this. Like, something's not good about this. So
do the members contribute articles?
Yes, absolutely. So we compile everything. We reach out to members. We help them build the articles. But it's a lot of volunteer work. We have a incredible editorial committee that has a lot of heavy lifting to do to keep it running. But now it's really, I mean, it's a, we could not have a magazine. It's 2025. But as people who work with our hands and build things, every time we talk amongst ourselves about, maybe we should get with the times and not have a print journal. None of us even really seriously consider it. We love getting it. We love holding it. We love seeing what everybody's up to. It forces us to slow down and listen to each other in a way that I think the modern world just doesn't.
Yeah. And in these days, to be able to hand somebody who's not familiar with it something that's so beautiful and well put together really does say something.
Yeah, well, I think one of the questions we always ask ourselves as we're putting the cover together these days and looking through the recent issues when I first got into the office and was just familiarizing myself with the overwhelming amount of paper. I just moved here in a semi-truck in a blizzard, as you must do when moving to Buffalo.
It's called a rite of passage.
Right. We want to put something on the cover that will, you know, the masthead says stained glass. And we want the image under that to immediately make you go, how is that stained glass? Like, that's right. People, I say stained glass to people and they think one of three things. Jesus, it's extinct, it's dead, it's a dying trade. Or, oh my gosh, my aunt makes tchotchkes and sells them at the craft show, right?
It'll look great over my couch.
Those are the three things people think about stained glass. And it's a trade of service, right? Like, we build giant windows, we install them, we leave. No. They're good for 150 years. We may never see that community again. We have more people working in stained glass today than we've ever had. We are a thriving industry.
That's what I was going to ask you. What is happening with the industry? Is it a growing industry?
It is a growing industry. We saw a surge during the pandemic. It's one of the four, like, you don't need a buddy and a furnace and, you know, a fire permit. You don't have to set up a big hot shop. You can have a very basic set of tools and head down to your basement or your garage or your kitchen table and pick up stained glass as a hobby. And we definitely experienced the benefit of people turning to those sorts of things in the pandemic. It is, that is not to say that it's not without its difficulties. On the East Coast, 90% of the work out there is preservation work. Mm-hmm. And I think, as all of us know, that is a struggle for a myriad of reasons, and studios do it for less than they should because they love the community and they want to save all the glass. But, you know, we're really experiencing the first major wave of restoration trade issues in the country. And not all of our issues align perfectly with what they deal with in Europe, so we can learn a lot from them, but some of the issues we have to work out on our own. And it's great to see young people coming into the trade and just loving to build things and wanting to scale up. And
do you dabble in it?
I learned from my mother, who learned from my grandmother, who had taken a class at like a community college.
Wow.
And then my mom ended up opening a retail shop, and I wanted to build big things. I did not enjoy making tchotchkes. at all. And I was convinced that I could build big windows, and the instructor I had, and it just goes to show like how little, even within our own industry, the myths that become legend, was like, oh, there are no big studios left. And then I visited my uncle in New York City, and he walked me into like a fourth generation studio in New York City. And it was pretty over for me.
Yeah.
At that point. So I don't build much anymore.
Yeah. You just don't have the time.
Right. I get to be an arts advocate, which is the only way to make less as an artist.
Yes.
Than being an artist.
So let's talk about where you're housed, because this is a really important piece of information. So for those who are in Buffalo and might not know, and for those who are not in Buffalo, you are housed at Trinity Church, which is one of two places in the world which has both work of both John Lafarge and Tiffany Studios.
In the same space. We might have actually found a third.
Okay.
Possibly.
Okay. So before we get into that, like, how did this, talk to us about this incredibly important site. How did the two artisans, did they work together? I think Lafarge was first, right?
I think Lafarge did. I think he was doing some things first. Tiffany had a lot more money behind him, and he was a marketing machine.
Hmm.
And
this was around 1885.
He really controlled the supply chain.
Hmm.
You know, he owned the glassworks where they were making the glass, and he would place these giant orders, and you were sort of left with whatever you had at the end, if you were lucky. And he had a huge studio. He had 150 people working for him at one point, and Lafarge had like three or four in comparisons. It was a constant battle between them two. It was really rare for a community to want work by both of them. But Trinity's always worked a little bit differently and had a very, so whoever was purchasing the memorial window wanted to work with who they wanted to work with. So we actually have five different studios work in the sanctuary alone at Trinity. And it's also a really incredible example of Tiffany Lafarge, because it has some of their very earliest work in it, as well as some of their work later on when they'd really mastered layered opalescent, the American sort of opalescent art glass that we think of when we think of those big Tiffany windows. So you can see the development of their styles when they start with glass that is not as mixed together, and they're still having to paint detail on the garments and the drapery, versus 10 years later, you have a Tiffany window that is like the Tiffany window, you know, the sort of luscious, the glass is like folded on itself and it's glowing and it looks like opals and moons, you know. It can't possibly be real glass. And my kids are like, I think the eyes are following me, those angels.
Amazing.
Right? And you don't try to convince them otherwise.
Are there any like instances where you found that Tiffany said something, or how what he thought about Lafarge's work?
The more I learn about Tiffany...
I wish people could see her facial expression.
Right,
she said that. Let's just say there was some consternation expressed.
He was kind of a jerk.
Okay.
I mean, it's not like the nicest guy.
Yeah.
My daughter's 8, and she wanted to do, she found out that women worked at Tiffany Glass Works, which was really remarkable at the time. He had a women's department, and he paid them equal to his men's department, which led to a strike by the men's department.
Mm.
And so my daughter wanted to focus on one of them for her Women's Month project. And we're reading a passage about how Tiffany would walk in and they'd be constructing this giant window, and he wouldn't like the colors they'd chosen in the section. So he would take his walking cane and just smash that section of the window out and make them rebuild it. Right? And
wow.
Right? And so like,
He did that to the men too, though, right?
No, he would. And at the factory, like if the glass coming off the line wasn't the right green, he wouldn't like allow them to sell it to someone else. He would smash it.
Mm.
And as some of my people would say, like, ugh, the caucasity. Right? It's like, right? Like, you have to be a rich man completely not worried about where your next sheet of glass is going to come from to do something like that, right? Where Lafarge is like scraping the whatever slag he can get off the ground. And there are these like, you know, some of those placeholder windows that you see when you go into an old building, and they have beautiful windows, and then they have some really plain window in the back with terrible like baby puke brown and pink colors in it. Those were also meant to be memorial windows. They were just waiting for the right rich family to come along and order them. And that's like the scraps off the floor that everybody else would have to be working with. So
in addition to Trinity, which is just, you know, as seminal examples of work as one can experience. I'm sorry, where is the other location, and where might be the third location?
They're in the Northeast, and I wish I remembered this off the top of
that's fine
my head, but like I'm from an island and I don't do maps.
Okay, really, that's quite all right. But suffice to say, it's extraordinary that we have it here. But in addition to that, Buffalo has incredible depth of stained glass windows, and is it considered one of the major sites for that in America?
It is, and it's a blessing and a burden, right? It's a blessing because we live in this incredible museum, but where do we find the resources to fix it all? Right? Like, it's a massive, massive burden on the communities that are still in these churches. And that is one of the main reasons why when Trinity popped up as a space, you know, the main role of the association is to serve its members, right? Is to make sure that we are up to date on best practices and provide that infrastructure for those industry related things to be happening. I didn't have fight a tariff war on my 2025 bingo card. I thought we'd sort of left that like well in our history, but there are two lead manufacturers left and one of them's in Canada. So it's been a very busy year in terms of advocacy work and helping the community navigate those new supply challenges. We dealt with some other manufacturing issues in 2016, you know, so there are like things that come along. We're a very niche industry and what we use, you know, is not like, doesn't like, we're not like the lead battery industry making electric car batteries, you know, like we have to keep relationships and partnerships in place so that when we come up against a challenge, we have the resources to deal with that. But personally, I wanted to be in Trinity because I wanted to be in the middle of the challenge for the community, right? Like, we were doing the work on the benches and we have our own struggles as an industry. And I'm a pretty strong believer in the fact that if we're ever going to have a preservation system that works a little better for everybody, we have to break down the silos, right? And each trade has kind of been in its own silo. That's why everything stained glass is dead. Like, we're amazing hermits. We love hiding in the basement, right? We're perfectly happy to not see humanity for months on end while we build these windows.
Is that what's happening in the basement of Trinity? Are you actually building windows down there?
I did move my shop to Trinity's basement. And we did, we brought the conference, the national conference here in 2023. Mm-hmm. And we actually, I think had 7 workshops going at Trinity. And I've done some kid projects there in the sanctuary. I keep expecting Matt Lincoln, the pastor there, to say no to me.
I don't think Matt knows no. He's pretty incredible.
Right. Yeah. I was like, I'm going to melt glass, like fire, in the sanctuary. And he was like, are you going to damage the sanctuary? And I was like, no. But the answer's no, right? And he was like, sounds amazing. I was like, okay. Right. So, but that's, I think we have to get trades like more in the middle of our lives. People don't understand how these things are built anymore. And so any opportunity I have to dismantle our processes and allow the communities we serve to see how it works, I'm going to do that.
Well, is it conceivable that you will take more space in Trinity Complex and build out the type of programming you do? And I mean, is that a goal maybe?
I have so many goals.
Yeah.
I have so many goals.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's segue to your goals. I want to know where you want to take this. Sky's the limit.
Okay. I love sort of nerd work. I would very gladly be the association's like technical writer nerd for the rest of my life. I would really love to study all of the sacred spaces in Western New York and how we came to have too many, not a popular opinion, but preservation work in the trades feels like firefighting, right? Like every single day the phone rings and there's a house, there's a church, there's something, the windows are falling out, it's over, like, get here, come save us. And we drop everything we're doing and we just 7 days a week.
Wow.
Those of us, even though there's more of us than there's ever been,
mm-hmm.
right? The need is very great right now. We don't understand the ecosystem well, and the funding system is not very well in alignment with the realities. And so we just firefight 7 days a week, 16 hours a day. People in this industry don't retire. I get a call from them 1 week on scaffolding in their 80s.
Mm.
And 2 weeks later, I get a call that they are gone.
Mm.
And another library is lost, right? We are not doing a great job of passing on generational knowledge. We're not doing a great job of saving all the stained glass, right? Because we're just trying to save it all as fast as we can with no thought to what can be saved, right? So there is resource scarcity. We're not making it better, right? We don't seem to have the right data and the right information to make community-wide decisions more efficiently.
This stained glass, are you salvaging it from buildings that are being that are at risk, or are they going back into these buildings?
Their warehouse is full of salvaged.
So you have a warehouse where you keep.
I don't. I have members that do.
Okay, gotcha.
You know, yeah. But you know, there are spaces that like stand out because they're in rural areas and they're the only church there, or they have really notable artwork, you know, and they really rise to the top, and you think we must save that. There are spaces we've probably already lost, right? Like if we are realistic from a trade perspective, we are losing things.
Well, think about all of the stained glass that got pillaged and pilfered all of those years,
right,
when these salvage, quote unquote, salvage,
right,
people would just go in and run roughshod over these,
right,
churches and remove these beautiful,
right,
stained glass windows and then sell them to other cities.
Right. And, you know, and then there's this huge gray area where if we could triage the work instead of firefighting, we could maybe save a lot more of it, right? Like when you read about how, and I get to experience this in real time at Trinity, we're renting almost every available space we have at Trinity. We have 9 nonprofits in the building now. It's really hard work to save a church. It is really, really hard work to reuse and repurpose a church. And we,
do you align with any of those other nonprofits, or are they all in?
I have no sense of boundaries. I am all up in everybody's business.
but I also wonder, do you align with Assembly House? I mean, are you working with other restoration/preservation trade organizations locally?
We're doing all that we can.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us are doing it in our spare time with our own financial tools, right? Like, because none of us have budgets to do that, and none of us have the staff to do it. When Assembly House is teaching the stained glass workshop, Catherine Mahoney, that has been teaching for them, comes over to Trinity, grabs a bunch of my tools, a bunch of my stuff, and sort of takes it back over there. Like, we're all doing everything we can. And I think that's where this sense of like God, there has to be a way to do this better. Like, we know resources are scarce, but I don't have a single studio that doesn't have a backlog of work, and there's more of us than ever. Why does this feel like an impossible losing battle?
What about any of the higher eds around Buffalo?
Stained glass takes, like, these crafts, these trades, mm-hmm. take years to master, at during which time you are not making money for anyone, right? Mm. And you can make a great life in the trades, but not if you have $120,000 of college loan debt. Mm-hmm. So
there's market, the system, there's market interest for the product.
Right, yeah. But the system is out of alignment with the need, and until we can, like, put that story together so that the system works better, mm-hmm. I think it's going to keep feeling like everything's on fire and we just have to keep working 7 days a week to fix it. And so that's a lot of my interest in, can we build a teaching space in Trinity? What can we do is built around that problem of
capacity.
How do we rethink the system? Mm-hmm. And look at what the community needs and use the scarce though they may be, use resources more efficiently to help save our communities first.
And for anybody and listening, we're all open to ideas.
Right.
Absolutely. Yes. And funding.
And funding, right.
So I just want to say congratulations on everything you're doing. It's just another amazing addition to the Buffalo landscape, particularly in, you know, there is so much happening around restoration, preservation, yeah. all of that. So to have this based here is just incredible. You know, per the focus of the podcast is there something that, you know, when our listeners hear this, they want, you can impart on them that they wouldn't know about? I mean, already we've talked about the fact that the second oldest publication,
right.
you know, you are based
it was
here.
Buffalonians that helped found
it was
the
Buffalonians
association.
Who helped
right.
found this, and not for nothing, you're in one of the most important sites in the world for stained glass. So
how about a place outside the church, someplace you've come across that, like, just you out of the blue, you said, oh my gosh, this is something I never thought I'd find in Buffalo.
Well, that would be all of Buffalo.
All of Buffalo.
Honestly, Buffalo never ceases okay. to amaze me in that sense. One of the projects that I thought was really interesting recently, we had a grad student reach out. They were writing about the stained glass light it's Canisius High School. I don't remember what it was originally.
Yeah, I think it was an auditorium. I've
right,
seen so images of it.
Yeah.
yeah.
And it has this sunburst, mm-hmm. you know, across the ceiling that is a Tiffany stained glass installation. And it is very, very similar to the sunburst in City Hall.
City Hall, yeah, exactly.
Same architect, but no one knows who built the stained glass in City Hall. I imagine, not to make anyone panic, but I imagine that the stained glass in City Hall is actually pretty close to needing some restoration work.
Mm.
And since we can't find who built it on any of the drawings or anything like that, I cannot wait for that to be documented, like taken down, cleaned, restored, because I'm guessing that somewhere there is a Tiffany signature. And I just think it would be so much, as I've also complained about his behavior and the smashing with the cane, I think it would be very cool if our City Hall skylight was built by Tiffany Studios. I think that'd be amazing.
What a project
amazing.
That would be.
Yeah. Right.
So, please report back.
Know.
If you yes. get that mandate, please report
right.
back. We'd our listeners are hanging on.
Right.
And, you know.
You obviously
waiting,
talked to Cynthia Van Ness before, right?
I have.
Okay.
I have. And if that doesn't qualify for a Buffalo Who Knew,
it
I can yeah. come up with like another 27.
No. That's absolutely yeah. brilliant. So I so appreciate you coming and fascinating what you're doing and good. And we are so appreciative that you're furthering the trade and it's happening right here. So
right here.
Megan, have all the best to you.